Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Hello, I'm Dan Perkins, and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation Weekly Update. Washington, D.C. Democratic congressman criticizes planned marijuana legalization vote, joining GOP members. A Democratic congressman on this past Tuesday joined his GOP colleagues in criticizing a planned House vote on a bill to federally legalize marijuana. Representative Connor Lamb, Democrat of Pennsylvania, weighed in on the chamber's pending action this past week on Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act, or the MORE Act, writing that lawmakers should be working every minute to get a deal done on the coronavirus relief and get money to people who need it. Instead, the House is voting on a piecemeal marijuana bill that won't become law. Decriminalization of marijuana is an important issue that should be taken seriously and done the right way. This isn't the right way, said the congressman. The congressman went on to say, right now, an American is dying every minute. People are going broke and nursing homes are still too vulnerable. We should be focused on nothing else but coronavirus. While more than two dozen Republican legislators have recently condemned House leadership for advancing a cannabis reform before passing another COVID-19 bill, no other Democratic member has publicly questioned the decision so far. But it's not entirely surprising that this criticism is coming from Lamb. While he previously co-sponsored modest reform legislation to promote research into medical cannabis for veterans and to allow banks to serve as state legal marijuana businesses, he voted against a bipartisan measure to protect state cannabis programs from federal intervention 2 years in a row. Vienna, Austria. The United Nations approves a WHO recommendation to reschedule cannabis in a historic vote. The United Nations Commission on Narcotic Drugs, CND, on Wednesday accepted the World Health Organization recommendation to remove cannabis and cannabis resin from Schedule 4 of the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotics Drugs. The historic vote in Vienna could have far-reaching implications for global medical cannabis industry, ranging from regulatory oversight to scientific research into the plant and its use as a medicine. Eagerly awaited approval of the recommendation 5.1 had a slim majority in favor with just 27 votes for, one abstention, and 25 votes against. The CND, the main drug policy making body of the United Nations, turned down all five remaining recommendations. The passage of Recommendation 5.1 carries broad symbolic significance for medical cannabis, as it could help boost medical cannabis legalization efforts around the globe now that the CND tactically acknowledges the medical utility of the drug. The medical cannabis wave has accelerated in recent years already, but this will give it another boost. Martin Jelsom, Drug and Democracy Program Director at the Netherlands-based Transnational Institute. And for those countries that basically mirror the United Nations scheduling in their domestic legislation, it may lead to national descheduling and remove obstacles to use cannabis for medical and research purposes. The vote could encourage countries to reevaluate how cannabis is classified on their own list of narcotic drugs, potentially paving the way for more research into medical marijuana and its use as a treatment for a variety of ailments and conditions. And of particular interest, the United States voted yes in favor of the 5.1 resolution. San Francisco, California. W420 Radio Network announced that a new edition of the BBS Network will bring America's Cannabis Conversation to 150 additional outlets. The show began appearing on BBS Network in mid-November and is expected to build to a sizable audience over the next 12 months. Mark Corsi, president of W420 Radio Network, also announced that the other networks added 27,000 new listeners in the month of November. The addition of 27,000 listeners to last month's audience now takes the audience combined in all networks at approximately 1 million listeners. Corsi went on to say that we are building the network and we believe with the addition of BBS and other possible networks to be added in the near future, America's Cannabis Conversation is the number one cannabis radio show in the world. That's your American Cannabis Conversation quick news. I'm Dan Perkins. Now let's see who's joining the conversation today. Joining us today on The Conversation are four new people that have never been on the show. First up is Susan Shearer, who is the founder of Heavenly Hash Ice Cream, an amazing product that helps cancer patients restore their appetite and gain weight. Then we have Dr. Molly McCann from New Frontier Data. She's going to talk about what's happened to cannabis during the pandemic. Dustin McDonald, Americans for Safe Access, is going to talk about the changes that need to be made to make consumption safe. And Ben Thomas, who is the director of the Department of Agriculture, the whole department for the state of Montana, talks about his program for a hemp exchange. And finally, there's a special segment for me on how we can help homeless veterans during this holiday season. So let's get into this conversation. It's going to be a great one. Welcome back to The Conversation. And joining us today is Susan Shearer, who has blown me away with a product that just tastes great. And it's also good for you. She's the founder and developer of Heavenly Hash CBD infused ice cream. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. We did another interview, which our audience can go to the archive sections of W420RadioNetwork.com and listen to that interview. But what I want to talk about now is, who did you build this product for and why? So in case somebody didn't hear the first interview, tell the audience what Heavenly Hash ice cream is.
Heavenly Hash Creamery ice cream is a high protein ice cream that's a super premium ice cream, which means it's a very luxurious ice cream. And it is developed for patients and consumers that are looking for a high protein need. And we do add with and without CBD inside of our product.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about who you built this product for. Who is the typical customer that could be listening to this show right now, and they could either be it for themselves or another family member? Who's your market for this product?
So it's really interesting because the origination of the product was out of my oncology and critical care experience and wanting to get a product to patients that had unintentional weight loss. And whether they were going through chemotherapy, whether they had cystic fibrosis, whether they had COPD, or they just can't keep weight on. And we know that protein helps you heal. Everything in your body, enzymes, receptors in your cell, everything is made up of proteins. And if you are not having enough on board, it can actually hurt more than it helps, obviously. And so with a higher protein content, you're able to heal faster. Your hormones are able to regulate better. And so the products out there currently that I saw with patients, which they refused to take, were tasting very grainy. They had bad texture. They had an aftertaste. And so it was originally meant for that market. And what's happened is, especially with COVID, is we've had people that have loved ones in nursing homes and they can't see them. And they're getting depressed and they're not eating and their loved ones are losing weight. And so here is a way to get a product into their loved ones to keep weight on. It might be the only thing that they eat. And so it was really important to address that market. We've had people that have had oral surgery that were told, listen, we're going to extract your teeth. You won't be able to eat anything but soup for probably in 4 weeks, and so you're going to lose weight. And so we go ahead and they try the ice cream. So it's really for anybody that needs that as a delivery system. But on top of it, once we added the CBD to it, anecdotally speaking, what I've heard other people saying is, it helps with inflammation. It helps with pain. So here you're able to take an ice cream that tastes fantastic, that has no aftertaste, and you're able to heal from it. And with some of the flavors, like I said, lemon, blueberry, that was developed for patients that couldn't taste, that lost their taste buds maybe due to chemo and radiation. And so I remembered working in the ICU, we used to use these lemon glycerin swabs to put in patients' mouths. And I thought, well, why not make an ice cream out of that? And so to have something that you can actually taste and to be able to have the benefits of cannabis on the other side. It just seemed like a win-win. And I believe that's for anybody. I talked to somebody whose father takes cannabis or takes CBD pills, but unfortunately he chews everything. And so he probably isn't getting much bioavailability in those pills. And so she loved the idea of being able to give ice cream. And, you know, ice cream just makes everybody happy. And so even if, you know, I just did some moving and I was sore and the first thing I did, I'm like, I'm having some ice cream. So that is the premise and the catchment population that we were looking to market to. And like I said, I remember this one story. This is really cute. When we first started, we got an order, and it was probably about 30 minutes away from where we were manufacturing it in an older neighborhood. I said, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and drop it off because I love meeting the people that consume the products, because I get reactions like you gave me. You know, they just can't believe it. I mean, the product really just sells itself. So I walked up, and here's this couple. I would say they're in their 80s, maybe like early 90s, and they had their lawn chairs out on the driveway waiting for me. And they were like two little kids. They were so excited. And I thought, that's it. That's what it's all about. We've had pediatric patients that won't eat hardly anything, but they love the ice cream. And they don't even realize in that 4-ounce cup, you're getting at least 9 grams of protein. That's so more per volume than anything else that's out there.
Susan, excuse me for interrupting, but let me ask the devil's advocate question. If there are other products on the market that have high protein in it, why would yours be better for patients than, for example, I don't know what the protein level is of ice cream that hospitals or nursing homes or cancer centers are giving to their patients, but why would yours be better than regular commercial ice cream?
So once again, like I said, it's a super premium ice cream. So what that means is that a lot of times when you're eating ice cream, especially cheap ice cream, you know, and that usually is what's put in hospitals is cheap ice cream. They're putting in about 50% air into the product. So you're eating a lot of air. You're not really eating ice cream. And so the protein content is very low. That type of ice cream that's in the hospital isn't really a protein supplement ice cream. It's just ice cream. There are some ice creams, or frozen desserts is what they call them. When you don't hit that 10% butter fat measurement in the ice cream, anything below that is not ice cream. Anything above that is considered ice cream. So if you're ever in the grocery store and you start looking at the packaging, you're going to see frozen dessert, because it's not really ice cream. Or they'll sell ice cream cups, and it's actually the cups, not really the ice cream. So it's all about marketing. But they have this one product that is a frozen dessert, and it starts out as frozen, but then if you wait long enough, it chemically changes into pudding. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Full of chemicals. That's not ice cream. There really isn't what we have to do when we talk about comparisons to our product. The only thing that's out there in that category is really Thrive ice cream. Again, you have Halo Top that has some ice cream, and you know they'll have 20 milligrams or 20 grams of protein in a pint of ice cream. Well, if we did that, it would be 36. Our taste is much more superior. It doesn't have that gritty aftertaste, and you are getting more protein per content. We have less sodium in our product. We have less sugar than some of the products that are out there. But again, the other products that do have less sugar have the sugar alcohols, which cause that GI disturbance. And so we are very competitive in the market, just in the ice cream market itself. And of course, CBD, we're the only company on a wholesale manufacturing. I'm sure there's people that make it, you know, in their smaller shops, but on a wholesale level, to be able to manufacture on such a large scale, we can manufacture up to about 1 million cups a month. On that scale, we definitely, we're the only ones that put CBD in ice cream.
So what are you producing now a month?
We can produce up to 1 million cups a month. We have the capacity to do that. I'd love to say we're doing that now, but we're not there yet.
Okay. Okay. When we talked, and if this is something you don't want to talk about now, you were telling me when we talked before that you were considering an e-commerce website. Is that still in the works?
Yes. 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 In fact, we've been on the phone today. So yes, people will be able to get the product through an e-commerce website into their state if their state allows CBD to be infused in food products. So as of yesterday, I believe Kentucky just approved that. New York today, I heard, is approving CBD in food, except they're putting a limit on it. They're putting a limit at 25 milligrams of cannabinoid in the food. So there are states that are turning, and those are the states that we can actually send product to. And it would be overnight shipped in a dry ice container. And
so,
we'll have that up and running, hopefully improved.
Mm-hmm. You're in Florida, and where else are you?
Currently, we are just in Florida.
Just in Florida, okay. Mm-hmm. And you have a wholesaler or a distributor in Georgia, as I understand?
So we have a distributor that services Florida and Georgia, and they are the ones that take care of our retail customers. So usually the customers that buy our product are physician offices, health food stores, vape lounges. There's a spectrum. And there is a couple in Texas. I should take that back, because there's one in Oklahoma and one in Texas that carries our product as well. But when we were able to, and we got the go-ahead to do the CBD ice cream, which was, I believe, in February 2nd of this year, of course, COVID hit, right? So mm-hmm. Right when you're able to get it out to your retailers to be able to service everyone, everything closes down. So we're just back up and running. And that's why the e-commerce site at one point would have accounted for 3% of the sales. And it looks like it's going to account for around 12% of our sales. And so it's very important that we get that up and running. And especially as we go to develop different other products.
Right. How quickly can you expand into other parts of the country as far as availability?
We are able to overnight ship it in most areas of the country. It's interesting. One of our partners, our e-commerce partners, they can't do Florida or Colorado, but they can do everywhere else. And then we have another one that can do everywhere else. And so right now, that's exactly what we're doing, is building our distribution network and making sure that we can get product to where it needs to go. When we talk about the non-cannabis product, there we're targeting healthcare institutions and bigger distribution channels, like using Sodexo and Aramark and some of the bigger distributors to be able to get that out to the world there.
So let's talk about helping people understand where they can find more information about you. And before we get there, one real quick question. Are you looking at product line expansion? Are you going to think about other things?
Absolutely. I'm very fortunate to be currently, I'm in a program at the University of Maryland for my master's in medical cannabis science and therapeutics. And, you know, one of the exciting things about that is I'm able to look at how are we going to use CBG? How are we going to use CBN and all these different cannabinoids and for different targeted therapies? And, you know, as that rolls out and we get the science and the evidence base behind it, where people feel comfortable, then we can add those to the product line. But a request we always get is, will we make a vegan line? And the answer is yes. And we also have a pet one coming out. So it's they're coming.
Good.
And
good.
Then we also have a licensing deal with Tommy Chung, which we will be making 3 flavors for him.
Right. So we've been speaking with, unfortunately, we're out of time, Susan. We've been speaking to Susan Shearer, who was the founder of Heavenly Hash Ice Cream. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, wow. The pleasure's been all mine.
Every week on the W420 Radio Network, America's Cannabis Conversation brings you information and insight into the exciting and ever-changing world of cannabis. Hear from our host, Dan Perkins, as he highlights the week's news, checks in with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association, and discusses medical benefits during our Cannabis Doctor On Call feature. You'll also hear regular contributions from cannabis correspondents Rich Walcott and Chase Roberts. America's talking about America's Cannabis Conversation. Check out the archive of past shows at americascannabisconversation.com.
This is Dan Perkins, host of America's Cannabis Conversation, and I want to hear from you. Send me an email. Tell me what you like about our show, what you don't like about our show, what kind of guests you'd like to hear from, and are there subjects that are important to you that we're not discussing? Let us know. Go to W420RadioNetwork.com and send us an email. Thanks for listening.
Joining us today is Dr. Molly McCann, who is the Director of Industry Analytics for New Frontier Data. Welcome to the conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I was fortunate enough that Molly sent me a sneak peek at a report that's coming out next month that she and her compatriots at New Frontier Data have put together on what's been going on in the cannabis business. And we're going to talk about that today. So tell us about some of the findings that you thought were really interesting about COVID-19 in cannabis.
Yeah, absolutely. So the report that we are working on that's coming out in a week or two is focused on consumers and how consumers' behavior has changed during the pandemic. So we did a survey of over 4,600 cannabis consumers in the U.S., all census adjusted. So we believe that it's pretty accurate in terms of surveying the population and represents the general population very well. So we were looking specifically at current consumers, and we call current consumers people who've consumed cannabis in the last year. And we asked them a number of things about how their consumption has changed because of the pandemic. And I think that the most important finding is that 42% of consumers say that they've increased the amount of cannabis that they use since the beginning of the pandemic. We saw, you know, early on after when states started shutting down and cannabis was declared an essential business, we saw this spike in sales. And we thought, you know, maybe this is just people stocking up because they don't know what's going to happen, and then we'll see a drop off after that. But in fact, we've seen that spending on cannabis has increased over the last 8 months and continues to increase. And we were, interested in what this meant for consumers. There were also, I should say, 16% of consumers said their use of cannabis has decreased in that time as well. And then the remaining 42% said that it stayed about the same. So everyone really is just experiencing changes in their everyday life, you know, like all of us have. And for some people, that means consuming less. And for a lot of them, it means consuming the same amount. But for 4 out of 10 consumers, it means consuming more. And for 18% of those, it was consuming significantly more than they had been before.
Molly, the Center for Disease Control reported about a month ago that 1 in 4 Americans is either suffering from anxiety or depression, which is an astronomical number of people. And I've discussed that on the show with Dr. Tischler, our cannabis doctor on call, and he was just shocked at that. Yet I think your report, if I remember reading it correctly, also addressed the issue of anxiety and depression.
Yeah, so we know that anxiety and depression, and then you know, on a scaled back version of that is what people like to call stress relief or relaxation, right? But it's all about, you know, adjusting one's mental health and trying to maintain a sense of wellness emotionally and mentally. So we also asked consumers how they were doing, how they would rank their mental health and whether their mental health has been affected during this time. And again, we saw that quite a few consumers, unsurprisingly, say that they've experienced worsening mental health during this time. About 40%, again, say that they that their mental health has deteriorated during the pandemic. And this is, I should say, it's not the same for every group of people. Female consumers were significantly more likely to say that their mental health had deteriorated, 48%, so basically half of women consuming cannabis say that their mental health has worsened during this time, compared to about 29%, so 3 in 10 male consumers. And then similarly, there was some differences between different age groups. We saw that younger people, the youngest group we looked at, 18 to 34-year-olds, they also had significantly worse, or you know, more likely to have worsening mental health during this time. So about 46%, again, nearly half of that youngest group of people say that their mental health has worsened. And it's about a third of older consumers. So consumers 35 and older, about a third of them say it's worsened. And then for the oldest group, interestingly, they 30% say that their mental health had deteriorated. This is 55 and older. And only 7% say that it had gotten better, which was much less than usual. So we have this oldest cohort saying, you know, nothing has changed, or most likely to say everything is fine, or, you know, not everything is fine, but my mental health has not changed significantly during this time. And then the youngest group most likely to say that it's gotten worse. So we asked specifically, how does cannabis fit into your addressing your mental health needs? And we saw that 52% of consumers said that they had used cannabis specifically to improve their mental health sometime during this pandemic. And again, it was more common among younger consumers. So for consumers under 55, it was more like 60% or so said that they had used cannabis to improve their mental health. And then interestingly, those consumers who are parents, specifically parents of younger children, were actually, I think, the most likely group to say that they'd use cannabis for their mental health. So 63% of consumers who have children under 18 at home say that they've used cannabis to improve their mental health during the pandemic.
Those are just both amazing and scary numbers, Molly, to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the National Cannabis Industry Association, which is a cohort of this on this show, recently reinforced its estimate that sale of cannabis, legal cannabis product in the United States will probably be up about 40% in 2020. They're also pointing to some of the mature markets like Colorado and California, where the market might be up 30-35%, which is unusual. My question is, are we growing the business, or are we switching the business from illicit to legal?
That's a great question. I think that's something that we're all really trying to figure out and measure, you know, exactly how much is coming from each. And it's one of the challenges of so much of this industry still, a majority of it in this country is still illicit. So, and that's really hard to measure, right? So I think first, to go back to your points about the growth of the industry, absolutely, it's growing really rapidly right now. I think I alluded to that a little bit before, but so we ran some kind of what if modeling, looking at some of the more mature adult use markets. So we looked at Colorado's adult use market and Oregon's adult use market, and took those months leading up to the lockdown, I think up through February of this year, and projected that forward and said, if we only had this much information, what do we think? What do we think that growth would have looked like over this time? And then we compared that against the actuals of what we've seen during the pandemic. And in Colorado, we saw 25% higher growth than we would have predicted since the pandemic began. And then in Oregon's adult use market, we saw 37% higher growth than we would have expected. So to your point, absolutely, the growth is happening. I suspect that we're getting it from both some new consumers coming onto the market, as legalization is spreading more and the stigma is going away around cannabis. And there's better patient education. People are becoming more informed. I think we are seeing new users come online and take advantage of, new products that are geared to them and new education available to them. I would suspect that the larger growth that we're seeing right now, in addition to just the existing consumers consuming more, as we saw through the survey, which I mentioned before, is these in places where there are both regulated and illicit markets, like in California, where I live. I think that we are seeing more illicit consumers start to come to the regulated market. And particularly now with health concerns about, sharing space with other people, right, and breathing the same air as other people. If you think about where a lot of illicit market deals happen, it's in someone's apartment or in someone's car. And if people aren't comfortable getting that close with other people and you don't know where they've been, I think that maybe a lot, I would suspect that quite a few consumers are willing to pay a premium to go into a dispensary, which is clean. A lot of them have curbside pickup now, so you don't even need to go inside. So I would suspect that that's where most of the growth is coming from, but we're continuing to try to figure that out.
So we've got about a little over 2 minutes left in this interview, and I do want to bring up one other issue. What we have seen in many places around the country, the expansion and development of home delivery. I have a gentleman who's been on our show numerous times, and he's in the business of buying cannabis businesses, whether it's growing, production, distribution. And he said if you wanted to get into the cannabis business today, this was prior to the pandemic, what you would do is that you would want to build a store that they call it the Apple Store look. Very high tech, very very comfortable, very clean, beautiful people working there, the whole nine yards. And he said in order to do that today, you got to figure you're going to spend between $500 and maybe as high as, depending on the size of the space, maybe $1 million. But a typical average between $500,000 and $750,000 to build a single dispensary. During the pandemic, a distribution company in Ohio for medical purposes only had spent about $750,000 each for five stores. They sold them for $350,000 each. And the rationale was that more and more people are going to delivery as opposed to getting into their car and driving to a drive-by pickup or going into a dispensary. From everything I can gather, that home delivery is one of the fastest growing segments of the entire industry. My question to you is, where do you think it's going?
Yeah, where it's allowed, delivery is quite successful for, on the consumer side, if you know what products you want, either because you've purchased them before or because you're very well informed about cannabis, there's not necessarily a reason to go into a store, right? If it can be brought to you where you are, that's much more convenient. I think a lot of people will opt for that. There are still going to be segments of consumers, though, especially new consumers. We've seen older consumers prefer this also. They want to go into a store. They want to be able to speak with a person, ask questions, look at the products before they purchase it. But I think that as consumers become more educated, more informed, we're going to see more we're going to see delivery continue to grow.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We've been speaking and having a wonderful conversation
with Molly McCann, Director of Industry Analytics for New Frontier Data. Will people be able to see this new report when it comes out in December online somewhere?
Yeah, just visit our website, newfrontierdata.com. And yeah, we have that plus a number of other recent reports on the consumers and on the U.S. industry.
Well, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome back to the conversation. And joining us today is Dustin McDonald, who is the Acting Policy Director for Americans for Safe Access. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. We want to talk today about your organization and why you were set up and what do you do. So tell us about your organization, Dustin.
Sure. Americans for Safe Access is the oldest and largest nonprofit patient advocacy group comprised of patients, researchers, scientists, physicians, all working to promote and ensure safe and legal access to medical cannabis for therapeutic use and research. The organization was founded in 2002 by Steph Scherer and has been working tirelessly since then across the states as well as at the federal level to work to educate lawmakers and regulators on the policy changes that need to be made to ensure that safe and legal access is possible for patients across the country.
Terrific. 2002, you said you started?
That's correct.
Wow, that's a long time ago. So in your job, what do you do?
In my job, I work to steer federal advocacy in Washington, D.C. So that's working with members of Congress, as well as coalition partners, other associations in the cannabis space, as well as industry who has contract lobbyists in Washington, D.C., to try to influence Congress and educate Congress, as well as the administration, federal departments and agencies like the Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Justice, about the critical reforms that are necessary for cannabis, things like removing cannabis from the schedule, passing comprehensive cannabis legislation. All those pieces are kind of critical to making this reality a possibility where patients truly can have and rely on safe and legal access to cannabis, where there's a standardized testing protocol, labeling protocol, taxation system to keep patients safe and also maintain a reliable source of medicine for patients. Beyond that work at the federal level, we do similar work at the state level. As you know, at this point, you've got a large number of states. There are 35 now that have some form of medical program. And you've got now 14 of those that have adult use on top of that. While there's been a lot of progress in implementing those reforms, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. A lot of state programs that were organized for medical still fail patients. Look at California as a perfect example. You have extremely limited access. There's not enough legal retail outlets for patients. There's still no protection. There's still no civil protections for patients in California from employer discrimination. So a patient could be a registered patient with the state participating in a state run health program and lose their job because of that. And that's not unique to California, certainly. That's the case across most of the states with medical programs. And so ACE is working very hard with our state chapters, our local chapters, to try to continue that level of education for state lawmakers, regulators, local lawmakers and regulators, really getting to understand, hey, cannabis is a medicine, just like prescription medicine, that you're used to seeing patients utilize to treat health conditions, and patients need to have the same level of reliability of product dosage, of product content, of product safety, and they need to have safe and legal access to it, and it needs to be affordable. So a lot of those issues still need to be worked out, and that's how what I spend a lot of time doing.
Good. There are a couple of sides to that coin that I would like to toss in the air and see how you come down. There are some people that I interview in the course of this program who say that we don't need two systems. We don't need an adult use and a medical. One is sufficient, and both parties can be served under one regulatory structure as opposed to having medical and recreational. What do you say to that?
I'd say we haven't really seen that borne out in reality yet. Americans for Safe Access released a report that we conduct an annual survey and issue a report every year that summarizes the functionality of these medical systems for patients. A lot of these systems have been online for a little while now. some as far back as the early 2012 in that arena. And so there's been a long time for those systems to have been tested out by patients and for patients to weigh in on what the challenges of those systems still are. Unfortunately, as the 2020 State of the States report illustrates, there's still a lot of work to be done in shoring up medical programs so that they function for patients. Patients continue to, in survey responses, continue to tell ASA that they don't have sufficient access. There aren't enough retail locations, whether they're adult use or medical in nature, for patients to access. So that means that patients are left having to navigate the unlicensed market to secure product that hasn't gone through government mandated testing or labeling requirements, and it puts patient safety at risk. That's the access issue, one. The second piece is patient rights and civil protections. Under an adult use program, basically the only thing that those adults, civil protections those adults are extended are related to possession and use and sale. So now you can lay down a driver's license on a counter that's valid and current and secure access to a product that is overly taxed, so you're paying extremely high rates in the adult use market. If you've got a functioning medical program, conversely, you would have protections put in place to enable patients to afford the medicine. That might be a complete prohibition on forcing patients to pay taxes. Patients typically under a medical model would be able to buy more cannabis medicine than an adult use consumer because patients need often larger quantities of cannabis as well as cannabis with higher plant compound volumes. For example, a patient is going to need specific medical cannabis products that typically have higher THC ratios, probably higher CBN, CBD ratios as well than an adult use consumer. So there needs to be specific products that are organized and available and readily available for patients. That's not happening in most markets. Those products need to be affordable. That's not happening in most markets. And those products need to be safe, labeled for patients. That's not happening in most markets. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done on the medical side. Adult use is not the silver bullet that you think it is.
Right. No, I agree with you. Yeah, you know, it's interesting that they were going to pass the Bring the More Act up, then they postponed it, and they made the leap from the More Act to decriminalization. Was there something going on that we didn't hear about?
I think what you're seeing now is a coalescing of all the momentum that has been generated in Congress so far, really over the last 4 years principally, but this last two-year session that we're nearing the end of. You've seen a lot of success of consideration of cannabis legislation, particularly in the House. That's really where the majority of the activity has taken place. But you saw the House pass things like the Safe Banking Act late last year. You saw the House take up measures like the MORE Act. Again, they're possibly looking to still run a vote on the MORE Act in December. You've got the Medicinal Cannabis Research Act, which has 105 co-sponsors. It's a bipartisan bill introduced by Congressman Luke Correa of Southern California with other members of the Republican Party as well. So you've got legislation moving out there in a bipartisan way, but you also have an incoming administration that isn't as far down the road in their thinking on how cannabis policy should be organized. We saw when Biden and Harris released kind of a couple of bullets on what they might do with cannabis back in May that really focused on decriminalization, focused on expungement of past criminal convictions, rescheduling cannabis to a lower schedule so that we could get more federal research plugged in on it. So I think they want to move it on a more measured pace than the pace that the nation has been moving at on this, because I think that's where, from an elected standpoint at the federal level, that's kind of where our elected leaders are. Most of the activity that's happened so far has happened at the state level, right? And so as that's happened, your federal policymakers are divorced from those things because they're in Washington. They're doing federal business. They're really trying to stay away from the state business on controversial issues to the greatest extent possible. It's the responsibility of groups like Americans for Safe Access, our coalition partners, industry drivers, folks on the health community, folks in the justice community, to continue to drive the administration, to drive at Congress, to push these reforms through.
Well, believe it or not, Dustin, we went through our time really fast. Thank you for all the insight. Tell the people, Dustin, how they can get a hold of you and follow what your organization is doing.
For sure. I would encourage anybody who's interested in getting engaged in this work to check us out at safeaccessnow.org. That's safeaccessnow.org. There you can find information on the campaigns we're running in individual states. You can learn information about advocacy, how you can plug into state and local campaigns. There's plenty of information that's available on there that's free, training materials for folks who want to get in on the advocacy side, as well as educational materials for patients and for doctors. Everything on there from, you know, what are the travel laws as you move from state to state. If you're a patient that needs to visit family in New Jersey, for example, can you take your medicine there?
Right.
Can you buy medicine there? You know, what are the laws for patients with respect to adoption, pediatric care? You know, if you're a patient and you're just getting into utilizing medical cannabis, what do you need to know about it? There's kind of cannabis 101 education on there, as well as how to talk to your doctor about cannabis. And then we have a lot of great information in there on training. So ASA also has its own training programs that is organized to train physicians, to train folks in the cannabis industry in all licensing categories, as well as physicians and doctor groups and government on best approaches to cannabis policy and how to utilize medical cannabis. So I would highly encourage folks to check out our website. Again, that's safeaccessnow.org. If you want to get in touch with me, I'm at dustin@safeaccessnow.org.
Dustin, thank you for a wonderful interview. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate it.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation, and joining us today is Ben Thomas, the Director of the Department of Agriculture for the state of Montana. Welcome to The Conversation, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. You have done something very unique in the hemp space, your state, than anywhere else in the country, and maybe it'll be groundbreaking. Talk to us about why you created the exchange and what's been happening.
So what we've experienced with hemp is, you know, there's a lot of uncertainties right now. The market is developing, but we have a lot of folks who are growing hemp, some who are looking to buy. Maybe they're a processor and they want various inputs, but they don't exactly know where to turn. They don't have those relationships. And so, of course, they call us. We get a lot of those phone calls, and we're kind of struggling with what to do with that because we don't want to pick winners and losers, and that's not really our place. But we also knew we didn't have to start from scratch. We had a very similar experience in previous years as wildfires kind of raged around the state as we dealt with drought in various respects. And we found at those times, people just wanted to donate hay, and on the other side of it, we had people who desperately needed assistance. So at that time, what we developed was the hay marketplace to kind of help people make those connections, and kind of we had that light bulb moment and realized that that same concept would work with hemp. And we announced it just a few weeks ago, and so all those calls we're getting on the buying and selling in were directing folks to that online marketplace.
So how active is it? How many players do you have on each side of the equation?
You know, it's slow to get going. We've definitely had a lot of interest. I'd say when we initially announced, a lot of the phone calls came from outside of the state of growers who wanted to put it into our market. Unfortunately, we're limiting it to those who are certified in our own Montana hemp program on the mm-hmm. on the supply side. So we've had to divert those folks. And now, you know, we've had a few send in their information, and we're just assisting them with, you know, filling out everything correctly. You know, we don't want them to just put hemp available. We want, as you can imagine, on the buying side of it, I mean, the uses are you know, so many, whether it's fiber or for CBD or for something else. The varieties differ drastically, and so we want all that information to be on there, and we're just kind of assisting people in making sure all that's filled out correctly so that people can really find what they're looking for.
So, Ben, if we look at the marketplace in your state, what size market is hemp right now? Is it a small market? Is it a growing market, a dramatic market? What's happening there?
I would say small and uncertain. And here's my perspective leading into this. We know there's a market out there, right? You know, on the CBD side of it, folks are spending so many millions of dollars on products that at least say they contain CBD. We know there's a fiber market. We know there's a lot beyond that, whether we're talking about hempcrete or something else. But we knew once the lid was taken off on this at the federal level that there would be a ramp up. And eventually I knew that either there would be a bust or there would be a pretty sudden softening of the market because it's easy to grow. We can ramp up production pretty easily. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have the quality, that we're going to have the right products available. And then the processing infrastructure is, you know, it's expensive. It takes time to develop. What we didn't expect is that the bust would be so sudden. So we went from 50,000 acres last year to much less than half that this year. So that's been a pretty sudden shift, and I'm comfortable with that shift. I would rather see a slow growth so that people, you know, when you have overproduction, there's always going to be a very significant and immediate impact on price. So it's hard for me to say how big the market is. I know there's a lot of interest there, and hopefully from this part out, there will be a smooth increase as we're able to better connect people. My vision is that, you know, we no longer rely on, imported products of various quality. We can grow quality here, but we have to enable our producers and we have to enable our processors in order to do so.
Do you think that it's possible that you could become a net exporter of raw hemp to other parts of the country?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think we could. You know, right now, I love to call ourselves a leader in the industry. There are a couple other states out there who are doing that as well, and we know how to grow. Great in Montana, we know how to grow a lot of, and just in terms of acres, we have the space, we have the land, and you look across the board for other commodities right now, and they're not in a good place. So our producers are always looking to innovate and step up where there's a market opportunity. As far as exporting out of the United States, that comes with a lot of challenges. But you know, we are a net exporting state. We're very proud of having captured that kind of quality corner, so that folks buying our ag products are willing to pay a premium because they know they're getting the best. But you know, exporting cannabis comes with challenges of its own, and
sure.
we'll slowly be working out those over time.
Do you think that the 50% reduction in production of the amount of hemp that you grew was a direct result of the pandemic, or was it other factors?
I think it played into it for sure. But there are many factors on leading into that, you know, you look at that 50,000 acres last year, and I talked with so many of these growers, and you know, as I say, commodity prices weren't strong, and so yeah, why not? This is an interesting opportunity. But what we also saw in that 2019 year is a lot of the players coming in, they may have had dollar signals, you know, in their eyes, kind of clouding their vision a little bit too much. When it mm-hmm. came to actually delivering on those contracts, we saw a lot more challenges. There was a lot of naivete, I think, in these folks who in the past probably didn't have a lot of experience or any experience in buying ag commodities. There's a whole world of regulation at the state level of, you know, who has to be licensed to enter in those contracts and what you have to do to get that license. So all of that stuff just kind of contributed to this failure of the market to some degree. It's unfortunate, but I also not a surprise to anyone closely involved in this industry. There's so much uncertainties, and we knew that going into this.
So did the 50,000 that went to 25, the 25,000 that went out of production, were there any bankruptcies involved that you're aware of?
Oh, no. No. There's definitely been an increase in farm bankruptcies over this last year, but it's not due to hemp. There's a lot more going on in this state, a failure of our food systems. I don't want to say failure, but definitely some tension there. So if there's been an increase in bankruptcies, it doesn't have anything to do with hemp.
Okay. So it was just a matter of oversupply versus demand.
Yeah, and not being able to connect people in the right way, and part of it's quality. I mean, it's one thing to grow a hemp crop. I mean, it's, you know, you put the seed in the ground and you water it and you see what comes up. And but that even if you're paying for expensive seed, that doesn't mean you're going to get a high value product. Depending on what you've contracted it for, they may be expecting certain levels of CBD. We're learning a lot about all the variables that play into that. We have so much more to learn. And so that's another piece of it as well. We're learning. This is kind of a massive nationwide research project. And yeah, it will take some time to work that out. But our farmers are nothing but innovators, and a lot of folks, even those who weren't able to get fully delivered on the contracts they had available, many of them don't regret what they've done and are still going at it because it's just an interesting and new opportunity and kind of an exciting thing to be a part of right now.
Well, thank you. We've been talking to Ben Thomas, who is the director of the Department of Agriculture for the state of Montana. Ben, tell people how they can follow what's going on at the Department of Agriculture in Montana.
Well, always check our website, follow us on social media. We're active on Facebook, and we try to give updates of what's going on pretty regularly. So, follow us anywhere you see. Google Montana Hemp, and it's there's stories out there across the media. You'll find growers coming together and sharing what they've learned. So, yeah, definitely keep your eyes open.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Ben.
Yeah.
America's Cannabis Conversation.